Should we begin with maybe the financing options available to startups to start with?
Sure. So typically, I think if you see from a startup point of view, or for that matter, you take any company, not even just a startup, a listed company or unlisted, or just a small startup. I think broadly, if you'll see, there are two kinds of options. There is equity and there is debt, right? So if I sort of elaborate or in very simplistically, equity is something where someone takes a stake in your business in exchange of an uncertain outcome. The outcome would be 100x, 1000x, or the outcome could be zero, right? So that guy is coming into your business, putting in money, and in exchange getting that stake. While the other one is debt, where essentially very simplistic debt, how it works is you take a debt and then you repay it over a period of X months with giving back the principal and some interest on top of it. So the outcome is very definite. And between equity and debt, if the company goes into a liquidation or something else, debt will have the first right of the cash flows, but an equity will have the remaining right. But that being said, the outcome which the debt guy can get is very, very fixed, right? Even if the company does exceptionally well, the debt guy gets the same amount, even if the company gets, let's say, a 2x thing, right? Same thing. So that's broadly it. But obviously, there are different options like revenue-based financing or a convertible debt, which lies somewhere between the spectrum of equity and debt. So some have a higher component of equity, some have a higher component of debt. These are guys are in between. So yeah, this is simplistic. Now, getting to a startup bit. So if you are a very early stage startup, I think the first option available to you is the equity one. And I'll just dive deep into why equity is needed and why debt is needed, and from where you should take equity and why debt. So equity is needed in scenarios where you are trying something which you are not sure of will have a certain payoff. But the likelihood is if that pays off, that will be a huge payoff, right? So let me give an example. Let's say what you are doing is you are experimenting that hydrogen as a fuel, right? And it's a research paper, something is available, but nothing is commercially done. But you think that there is a possibility of hydrogen run cars being run. And if you just think about it, the amount of the petrol, diesel, now CNG and electric vehicle, the TAM is very, very huge. So if you think about it in mind, even if you can capture 1%, so payoff if the venture is successful is very, very high, but it's very uncertain. More likely than not, it will not happen, right? But if it happens, it will be a huge one. So in these kinds of scenarios, you need equity, right? Because it's uncertain. On the other side, why you need debt? Debt you need for a couple of reasons, because see, equity, again, coming back to the previous thing, because the payoff is uncertain, right? And a payoff is huge and the probability of payoff is very uncertain. So the guy who's putting in money will expect a higher sort of return from you, right? Compared to if it was a, let's say, a very, very definitive cash flows. So what it ties back to that equity is very costly. Equity on a private side is anywhere between 30-35%, right? Which is the internal expectation of VC funds, right? So that is how they are
So,
there.
sorry, I mean, in a sense, when you say 30-35%, you mean when they invest in a round, they expect at least that much, is it?
Yes. Oh, this is per year, per annual. So if they invest for a 5 year period, they will probably expect a 1.35 raised to the power 5 or raised to the power 10 based on their holding period. So annual return expectation is broadly, let's say, a 30%, 35% kind of thing, because it's a risky bet, right? If you think it from an investor perspective or a person who's putting in money, his own money to use, I can do an FD at 7%. I can invest in stock market, which is very liquid. I can sell at any time, and probably I will earn anywhere between a 12 to 15% in Indian stock market, right? That's a broad history. So if I'm taking this higher risk, and on top of it's a illiquid asset as well, I cannot sell it even if it has gone 100x. I have to find a buyer for my stake, right? So all those things put together, I expect at least a 30% kind of it's called as IRR, right? Which I expect from my investment.
You were
Now,
talking about revenue. No, I thought you were talking about 30% of stake when they invest.
no,
I was
not a
confused.
stake, not stake. It's return in return
Understood.
expectation. If I put in 100 crore, you give me 30%. It's again, it's not definitive, it's a broad expectation. So to this point, I think when I was coming, when I explaining about debt, why I'm saying all this. See, equities, and that's why, because the risk is high, the expectation of return is higher, this 30-35%. It may or may not materialize, right? Most likely than not in India, I think many funds have not even returned the principal as well, let alone the IRR of 30% or so. But if I am taking a bet, I have to have a reasonable expectation that I will make this much. Otherwise, if the reasonable expectation is, even in the best case, I am making 15%, that's not a venture bet, right? For a venture capital, right? Now, to this corollary to this is, now we come to the debt side. Because it's 30-35%, someone is letting go of that return, right? If you are a startup founder, right? You are very sure that your business model will grow at and deliver this 30-35%, 100% sure, right? Then why are you taking equity? If that is a sort of money you would make if you would own 100% of the company, why you are leaving 20%, 25% or whatever stake to a VC fund, right? So, because you are not sure, right? Other, if you would sure, you would put your own money and you will not raise for a VC fund, right? So that is there. Now, on the other side, let's say there's a other kind of company, which is a consumer brand. Let's say you are selling, for example, BPC, let's say cosmetics and all. It's a very predictable, you know that there is a certain gross margin, contribution margin. You will need some money at the beginning to make your brand and to invest in some things. But let's say you reach a 5 crore, 10 crore scale, right? You have a very reasonable outcome that I will put 1 rupee in ad. I will get 3 rupees in revenue. My profit will be this much. And the uncertainty has gone down, right? And because uncertainty has gone down, the other guy may want to give debt to you, right? Because he's very certain that you might not give very large, but let's say you can deliver this kind of growth rate and cash flows and everything, and you can service my debt, right? And on the contrary, you are saving your equity dilution. You do not want to become, have a unicorn company where you own a 3% stake, right? What are you left with? You are left with $30 million. In essence, if you are, let's say you get an outcome of $300 million owning 50% of the company, you own $150 million of stake, right? So it's a balance and act. So I think you start with the equity. Once you figure out that there is a very PMF is reached and you have a good trajectory or good method or scientific way, you have found out that I will put X money, I will get Y money. It's a very predictable outcome. Take debt, right? It will save your dilution. Now, I was explaining I'll take just a minute more. There is a revenue-based financing, right? It's in between. This is for startups which are in very early stage, which let's say are not able to get equity, or the founder does not want to dilute equity, right? He says, I want to understand. Or the other point is, now no equity investor sees that this company can deliver this kind of return to me, so I will not invest, right? So, and debt guys also say that there is still unpredictability, so the company may or may not give my cash flow back. So there is revenue-based financing is a form of debt, where the interest rate is a little variable, right? The payout is a little variable, depending on how successful was the company. Let's say if you do 2x revenue, you return me X percentage. If you do 3x revenue, you will return me Y percentage. So if you do good, I do good. If you do bad, I do bad, kind of thing. But that has some boundaries. It can't be like 0 and 100, but it has certain boundaries. And overall, RBF is between equity and debt in terms of IRR expectation. Let's say a debt would expect something, let's say 15%, equity would be 30% expectation. RBF would be somewhere in between 22%, 20% kind of expectation.
Could you define what is IRR and RBF?
RBF is revenue-based financing. So revenue-based financing is basically, let's say this cosmetic brand example, you are doing a business, you know that I have to spend 100 rupees on marketing today and I will get back and I will able to do, let's say, 300 rupees of sales from this 100 rupees of marketing which I have put up. And this 300 rupees is less, give me back, let's say, 150 rupees of a contribution profit, which is a profit I would make out of it. So out of that 150, I will give back the revenue-based financing guy 100 rupees back, plus what I owe as an interest to him, and I will be left with whatever is remaining with me. So this is RBF. IRR is generally, it's a simple thing. Let's complicate it. It's an annual return you make on any investment. So there are many terms like CAGR and other kind of return. IRR is very used in the ecosystem just to as a proxy for how much return you are making on an annual basis.
So on debt, see, I'm coming at this from like in a general mentality, I feel taking debt, or like if you look at culturally also, I feel taking debt in general is considered like a bad thing. Like in the sense that people hesitate to take debt, or even in like pop culture, I've noticed that, you know, anything is fine, but you don't want to be, you don't want to take another, you don't want to take it, you don't want to take a debt because you fear that there is this endless cycle of repayment and you will just kind of get stuck in that. So that is one part. Second part is I've watched a bit of Shark Tank as well. And in Shark Tank also, what happens is even though they're coming for like VC funding, in general, I think most of the times what happens is it is a combination of, let's say, they will invest, but also there is a debt component as well. So they will, let's say if they're coming for 1 year, I think they'll do like a 50L equity, and then 50L, they'll service it at, let's say, 12% debt component. So is my thought process of like thinking about debt in a very bad way, is that like an old school way of thinking, like, you know, how people in the old ways used to think about debt? Is that mentality of debt the wrong way to think about it? And I don't know if any comments on the way Shark Tank deals are also structured. Yeah.
Sure. No, interesting question. And this question we also deal repeatedly. I think one thing we see is the second time founders and founders who value their equity a lot, they are actually on the other side. They want to take debt, right? And I'll tell you why and why not. I think both pros and cons. So the pros is simple, right? Let's take your example. You're saying that I took a 100 rupee debt, and what if I'm not able to repay, right? And what do I do with it? I'll there's other corollary to it. I don't know if you know. So in venture capital, so let's say you buy a share on the stock market. Let's say you buy some share on the stock market, XYZ stock at 100 rupees, right? It goes, something bad happens or whatever happens, that stock goes to zero. You lose that 100 rupees, right? You can't claim someone, right? That is known as secondary transaction, because you bought a 100 rupee share from someone, he got the 100 rupee, but the last time the share was with you, something bad happened and the stock price went to zero, or the company went bust or bankruptcy or whatever. Right? Now, on the other side, if you see how startups investment work, there's a preferred component to it. And I'm saying this on the equity side. So if, let's say, the VCs have put in 5 crores, and if the company is, let's say, ran for 2 years, after that it sold for, let's say, 6 crore rupees, right? Or let's say not a 6 crore, let's say a 4 crore amount, the company, the founder will get nothing, right? It's because the way VC funds invest in a startup, it's known as preferred equity. So that is above the common stock, which is generally a founder owns a common stock, and then it's a preferred equity. So even if you have raised 5 crore and your company sells for less than 5 crore, all the money will go to the VC investor, founder will get nothing, even if the company was sold for something, right? So my point is, I understand that where you're coming from the debt side, that why people are averse to it. See, in our culture also, I think maybe debt is frowned upon. But if you see on the other side, if you see the balance sheets of, let's say, a Reliance, or let's say even any large conglomerate, no one except a very few have become very big on the through equity, right? Equity has its own. I'm not denying that you replace 100% equity with debt. I think in the startup sense, 80% equity, 20%, that is a good fill. Maybe in the listed company or the companies where its infra component is higher, the debt component is even high, equity is even lower, right? So that is there. But I think the right way to look at it is, how sure are you that you will be able to repay sort of the debt? And the pro is that you get to save your equity, right? And you get to dilute equity at the later stage, or you will not. So that is very, very important. And to your point on why Shark Tank deals are happened at, let's say, equity component, debt component, because see, sometimes the other way around is, all businesses cannot become $1 billion businesses. All business cannot become a $10 billion. Sometimes the outcomes are capped, right? Let's say I'm talking about this BPC company or a consumer brand company, right? Generally, if you'll see, consumer brands upside is a little capped compared to a tech companies. Let's say, right? Because consumer brand, you will have the people can enter, right? New brands can come in, there are existing players, right? Let's say if I'm saying that you want to replicate a Facebook, even though you're saying Facebook is dead, Facebook is going down, whatever, right? It's damn difficult to replace a Facebook. The upside is a lot higher compared to consumer. So in those kinds of cases, I think founders, if founders know that there is a cap and the business cannot generate that kind of IRR, that kind of return for the investor, why would investor invest in the equity? Because he may see that the company might not be able to deliver that kind of return. So it's beneficial on both parts as well, both on the investor side also and on the founder side also. You get to sort of save on the equity side. And I think there are certain use cases where debt is very, very important. For example, going a little technical. So in a company, there is a working capital, right? There is inventory you have at your warehouse. There is a money which you are owed by your sort of customers, right? Let's say your customers pay back you in 30 days. You have 100 crore of revenue. So every at any point of time, you will have 100 crore of outstanding in your books, right? Someone owes you 100 crore rupees, right? And let's say you have, but that is a very realistic outcome. That out of 100, you are very sure that 99 crores will come back, right? If not today, in 1 month, right? So why do you want to block equity for those kind of endeavor? Very again, to my earlier point, the predictability is very high in terms of cash flows, right? You have inventory in your warehouse. You are very sure if shit hits the fan, you can sell that inventory at a very, very sort of price, at a very close price or whatever that is available. So on those kinds of scenarios, that is a very, very good sort of use case.
So predictability, when it comes to predictability of revenues, or when you're certain that this business model might be successful, or the business that you...
Sorry, I think I lost your voice.
Can you hear me now?
Can't hear you.
You're not able to hear me at all?
No, I can't hear you. I'm not sure why. Let me disconnect my phone. Yeah, can
you? I am.
Yes, I can hear you now.
Yeah, able to hear me now?
Yes. I think might be some issue with my phone. Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. So, just to make sure I understood this, in the sense that when there is predictability in the business model, or in the sense that there is some certainty with the business that you're trying to approach, there is some certainty that, you know, it can see success, then maybe debt component makes a lot of sense. And in terms of like equity, if the payoff is uncertain, then investors also are looking for extremely high returns. And also it's like, even for the founder, since it's very risky, there are not many people who will be willing to fund it. It's not like charity.
Yes.
And for them also, yes, it makes like a lot of sense.
The issue is not very binary, right? It can't be like 100% equity, 100% debt. It will be somewhere in between. You are a Series A company, you will have 10% predictability, take 10% debt. Let's say you are a public company, let's say Reliance has lots of debt on its book because the predictability is literally high. So it's a spectrum. You move closer and closer and see what it does to you. I'll just, last point, cutting you off. So the cost of equity is, let's say, 30%. Cost of debt, let's say, is 10%. So what happens is, a company which has a lower cost of capital, how the cost of capital is computed, it's a weighted average of debt and equity. Let's say you have 50% debt, 50% equity, so 50 into 10 plus 50 into 30 divided by 100, right? So two companies in the same sort of business, right? If one has a very, very low cost of capital, one has a very high cost of capital, right? So that is a competitive advantage as well, right? If you have everything in equity on your books, 30%, so there is a measure called return on equity. Your return on equity will be lower. And if that is lower, investors might not want to invest. Investors are looking for a business where return on equity is higher than a certain threshold, right? So that is there. So but that is not from a startup perspective. That is more if you become a very large company, let's say a Series D company or a unicorn or maybe like a Nifty company.
So just to backtrack, earlier we spoke about for at least the VC space, the venture, the payoffs being uncertain. Second, we also touched on, like, in the Shark Tank deal, how some of the outcomes may be capped, and not every business would be like a $10 billion business. And I'm also trying to touch on one of the earlier statements you made was like investors in general might be expecting, let's say, 30% returns yearly. Or at least ballpark of that number. So could you maybe give us some clarity on like what kind of businesses it makes sense to maybe get venture funding? Like, if I know that my startup will never be like a Facebook, or it will never generate like like, you know, $1 billion outcome, does that mean that for me venture funding does not make sense, or how to think about it?
Sure. No, it's a very, very valid question and very relevant question in the ecosystem, right? So I think of it this perspective. See, earlier, I don't know if you know, so how venture funded VC and all this came into play, right? Earlier, people used to fund voyages. I don't know if you know, so, right? So let's say...
I don't know anything.
Okay. So I'll explain. I think what happened in initially, and this was probably 300, 400, 100 years back. So some sailors get together and they say that we'll explore a geography. Let's say they were American sailors. They say we will explore a geography. It could, whatever it could be. And you fund us. If you find something, we will give you a share of it. Right? We'll come back. We'll give a share of it. But if we don't find something, you don't get anything. So that was our original venture sort of investment, right? You know, payoff is unlimited. Theoretically, I don't know, Vasco da Gama would have funded, I don't know, by this logic. And they would have visited India, took something from India, probably distributed to the guys who funded him, right? This was it. So I think one way to think about it is the more weird the idea, the more futuristic the idea, more venture backable it is, right? Because the payoff, how large it can become, I think maybe you and me cannot think of it at this point of time, right? On the other hand,
just to push back, I mean, does that mean, I mean, I'm not convinced there actually, in the sense that some ideas may be very weird, but they may not be able to generate like really high returns, right? Like,
sure. No, I mean, take a bet on it. So I think how you are define a payoff. So the payoff would be, if I'm a VC fund, I'm doing a, let's say, a $1 million check at $10 million valuation, right? I am thinking, let's say I will make good money if the company becomes a $1 billion company. Let's say 100x exit for me, right? For that to become, I want that this company is operating in a market, let's say, which is a $100 billion market, right? Very large market. And let's say I attribute that 1% of that would be successful. So 1% of 100 billion is like $1 billion. So that's I see outcome. But that being said, I would say it's a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. What that means is you can come up with everything. No one owes you anything, right? No one can say, "VC, this my idea is very different, very great." And it operates in a logistics space. It's a 200 billion industry. I can make out of it. No. So you'll have to back it up by facts also. So for example, you say that I want to do something in this logistics space. Let's say, think about it, how Uber came in, right? This guy said that, Travis said that this market is very, very huge and there is no one place where I can aggregate. I will do this aggregation. At that point of time, if you'll see the market size they estimated of the entire cab market in the world, Uber is doing the entire GMV today itself. On that, so the market has expanded like tenfold, right? Which you could not have predicted that, right? And still this guy was rejected out of 100 VC meetings, right? It's not like he got the first funding; he was rejected out of 100 VC meetings, right? But someone found out that this is a bet worth taking because the founder was gritty. So I think at early stage, the idea you are working on, I'll give you some brief benchmark of why your idea should be VC one. You are working in a very large market, right? It should be a very large market, very large market. You are not working on a very, very niche or space, which does not potentially can be extended to a large space. It should be a very, very large market. Founder should be gritty and all the typical attributes you associate with a founder. The founder should be patient yet impatient in terms of driving results. I personally see that founder should have some experience in the things that you're trying to do, right? If I have worked my entire industry in the finance space and I want to do something in the pharma space, and a founder came to me, I will know why you are doing something. What is the insight you have that no one else has, right? So something of that sort. And obviously what he's trying to do, how different is it from the existing solutions, how large it can be, why is it different and all those things, right? And this can be a given paired out. In some other cases, but this is like the truest venture bet, right? But those kinds of companies are sort of, if I want to say, it's little rare in India, right? In US, you can find those companies who are working on R&D, let's say on something else, on a very weird thing, right? Or a very different thing. India, I think it's a mix. We have startups who are doing, let's say, these satellite startups. They are doing amazing thing, right? What they're trying to achieve is they are pushing the sort of the envelope what ISRO has done. They are going beyond it, right? So that's a sort of a true venture bet in India, which you can sort of look around, right? And there are other businesses which are derivatives of it, which say that this ecosystem, let's say this pharma supply chain, this fintech, you'll say lots of fintech companies there, right? Finance is such a, lending is such a large market. But still there are unserved segments in the market which a bank or NBFC cannot cater to for whatever reason, right? Regulatory reason or some other reason. So in those cases, they say that given it's a large market, there's underserved segment, even if the 5% people are underserved. And even if I take the 1% of that 5%, it's still a very large outcome. So VCs, those kinds of companies are also funded, right? So I think, and to your point where we are coming from, why, which type of companies would be VC funded? I think these 5-6 attributes should be there. Large market, you should be differentiated enough, what you are doing, which others are not doing, and obviously the founding team, right? That's the, I think in the very early stage, founding team is everything, even more than the market, I would say, right? As the business matures, the weight is more on the what you have demonstrated in business, how large is the market, and I think because founders pedigree will be started to see in that point of time, right? But within 4 or 5 years, you'll see that the startup has become this big and all, and that then data takeovers.
You're saying the founding team is more important than the market, is it? I thought if the founding team is like much good, but if the market is very small, it doesn't make sense. No, I don't know.
So if I give you a F1 car and I give Michael Schumacher a Alto, will you be able to beat him? I think we can argue. It can happen other way around also. So my point is, it's a debatable thing. I think it's both things. I think as early as you are in your journey, the founding team is more important as you go late, because then you cannot change your market, right? So we have seen certain, think about how Paytm started, right? It was it was a VAS service, value added service on mobile, on those feature phones. So they used to push those ads, and see where are we today with Paytm, and it's a $7-8 billion company. So I think in very early stage, founder is important. I think founders is important. I think market, even if the VC is not convinced that it can be very large and all, it can be tweaked a little. I won't say it can be, it may be pivoted also in early stage, but it's debatable. I let's put it that, but founder is very, very important in the very early stage. I'm saying in the seed, pre-series A kind of stage.
Like even if they don't have clarity at that point in time, the ability to maybe discover new markets or enter new segments can be a huge, can give more like high returns or, you know.
Yeah, so I think there is unpredictability at that point of time. So some VCs do take that bet, that founder is saying, I want to do something in the fintech space. Like, and it would be, let's say, related to lending or consumer lending. And I have these insights, these 5 insights, and I started working on it. But the point is, see, it's different, right? If a three-time founder is coming to a VC and saying this, that's more trustworthy. If I am going to a VC who has never done a startup in my lifetime, right, I might be less trust. So it's a fun feature of trust, your sort of what is a background you have, how much you have demonstrated that you can, your words can be taken as your actions as well. So those kinds of things. But I think in current scenarios, it's also depends on the market sentiments and all, right? With the current cost of capital, which is higher, right? More focus on valuation, profitability and other things. So those kinds of deals will be a little lower, but lots of such deals happened in 2021, right?
So, yeah. I was really surprised when you said that Uber, the GMV, is it? That they promised, yes. They have already covered that today, like they're already doing it today.
Yes.
That was really interesting.
So it's an interesting thing. So no one, and if you ask some VCs who had invested in 2005, 2010, right? Many of them underestimated the market size in terms of tech, right? Just think about it, right? When we were in schools, we were doing those simple phones, and who thought that you would be using 30 GB or whatever highest number of data per month, right? People are using 2 GB, 3 GB data per day, right? That was unimaginable, right? So some cases, because when there's an inflection point, things change, right? So you can't predict those things, but yeah.
So we have discussed, one is equity financing, one is debt financing. And then we also touched a little bit upon what kind of businesses does it make sense to take venture capital. On the financing issue, or on financing, does the there are various sectors, right? Like, I mean, there is fintech, there is healthcare maybe, or, you know, space. Do the business models or the sectors that people operate in, does that play a role in what kind of financing that you might be looking for? Is one better than the other? Or any general thoughts on, like, for different type of sectors, what can, in terms of, like, financing, is there, like, any core new insight, or do you think whatever you've said till now, that kind of fits in really well?
I think broadly what I said is covered. I think obviously there are certain nuances to all types of businesses, right? So for example, let's say, I'll tell you, for example, lending is a very big segment, both on the venture side and on the public market side as well, right? Typically, let's say a bank gives you a personal loan at what, 11%, 12%, a typical large bank, right? If they are giving you a loan at 11, 12%, their blended book would be way lower because house loan is cheaper, car loan is cheaper, education loan is relatively cheaper, right? And business loan is a little low. So what I'm trying to say is a bank makes, let's say, giving a loan at 12% on an average, right? They can't be borrowing at more than 12%, or they can't be just using equity, right? Equity stock market guy will expect a 15% kind of return. If you are making 12% on a loan, how will you give that guy 15%? So that's why banks take deposits. Bank takes saving account, which they give like 2%, 3%, 7% on FDs, and they leverage, right? Typically, a bank leverages a debt is like 5 times of whatever their equity is, right? So 1 rupee of equity, 5 rupee of debt, because that's how their cost will come down and they will make money. The corollary to this is on the fintech startup side, right? A fintech startup typically operate in a little higher segments on the riskiness side. They will lend to people who the banks will not lend to. They will, let's say, make a 20% IRR, or they will target a 20% IRR. Again, they cannot be just doing it on equity, right? Because if you deliver a ROE of like a higher number, right, then how you can make money? So they also have to leverage. So I think on the venture debt side, we see fintech lending companies, the B2B commerce companies, the consumer companies, they take a lot of sort of venture debt, because inherent business model needs those kinds of things, right? That is, there maybe once the satellite businesses, they have a some visibility on the revenue side, we'll be happy to back those kinds of companies also, right? Will they figure out a business model that one satellite makes this much money and all. So, and we will be able to sort of fund those kind of companies. But obviously you're right, this depends on a business model and some nuances on the business as well. Sometimes it cannot be avoided. Let me put it this way. Sometimes that cannot be avoided because a business model is such. And sometimes it's a choice depending on you want lower dilution or you are okay with a lower outcome for you in terms of lower uncertainty, right? So that's a founder choice. In some cases, it's unavoidable.
I want to take one digression here since we are on the business model topic. So in my opinion, my understanding in general has been that generally, VCs tend to, like, for most startups, like, they will take, the companies will take a lot of funding, and then they will scale the startup or grow that startup as much as possible. Up until that point, it'll be like a loss-making startup. And only once it hits a significant scale will they start making profits, and then the VCs will end up making money, right? So is that a fair assessment, or?
So see, VCs make money by two ways. They when the shares where they have bought, they will sell those shares, right? So they can sell those shares in two ways. One is, let's say an investor came in at Series A stage, seed stage, right? They may sell to us another investor who is coming at Series C stage, right? So they can, but generally what happens is typically those are known as secondary transaction where the company is not involved, right? One investor is selling to another investor. Those are known as secondary deals. Primary is where the company is getting the money. So generally what happens is in the later stage, whenever there is a primary round, there is some secondary which also happens. So the company will say the older investors that the new investor is putting in some money in the company, but they have kept some money as to buy shares from the earlier investors as well. So if someone wants an exit so I can facilitate, the company will say, and the new guy will buy. So that is one. Or they can wait to a company, or they say that I don't want to sell today, right? Or the late stage CVC investors say, I do not want to sell today. How do they make money? They wait till there is a liquidity event. Liquidity event is known as anything. Let's say there's acquisition. let's say Microsoft acquires you, Google acquires you, that's one kind of acquisition, and you will get cash. Microsoft will give a cash or Microsoft shares to the guys who were invested in this company, the target company. Or what happens the other way around is you list like a Zomato or a Paytm, you list on the stock market, you get public shares and you can trade it. And now you can, it becomes fully liquid, right? You want to sell to anyone, you whatever you want to do, right? Now to the other point, I think that companies making losses and then VC funds make money when company done profitable, that is not actually true. Those are independent event. I think this share exchange can happen irrespective of if the company's profit or profit making or not, right? So for example, Zomato listed, it was a loss making. Paytm was loss making when it listed. Policybazaar was loss making, right? And Zomato just turned profitable yesterday, right? So, but it had a lot of exits in the past in terms of secondary exits. That is not there. I think the point to here is why, the question to ask is why they were loss making, right? Could they have become profitable way earlier? They could, but then you are letting go of the potential growth you could be. Like, for example, Zomato and Swiggy were competing 5 years back, 4 years back, right? If Zomato had said that I will just focus on growth, profit today in 2020, they would be, let's say, one third of the size of Swiggy, because Swiggy would have expanded a lot, reached to many consumers. So it's a bet between market share and how fast you want to grow versus profitability, right? And I'm assuming that you are in loss because you are investing in new sort of customers, new restaurant, let's say example of Zomato, new investments, or you are targeting new geographies. If your inherent business model is wrong, that and every new order you are making a loss, that is a very gone case. So that, I'm not talking about those kinds of cases, but that was not the case with these companies. They were investing in sort of things which will pay off in future and which they have started paying off, right? So, and it's also dependent, I'll bring out this point again, it's dependent on the cost of the capital as well. But even the cost of capital, for example, think about a sovereign fund, a Canadian fund, a US teachers fund, right? They could buy a 10-year bond of US government, right? That is known as GSEC in India, right? And in US also, there are these funds available. Earlier in 2020, you were making 1% on it or a 1.5% on it on a 10-year bond. Today, you are making 5.5% on it, right? So the teacher fund will say that earlier I was allocating very less to this government securities. Now the return is higher. I'm contributing a lot more there as an investor. And hence, I am putting a little less money in VC funds, right? Because I am getting a higher guaranteed outcome. So in this kind of scenario where the cost of capital has gone up, the market share or the your how your revenue is growing, the value of that goes down, the profit value goes up. Tomorrow, let's say the interest rate move very way down, like interest rate goes 300 basis point from a 5% US rate goes to, let's say, a 1% rate, right? What happens is suddenly the value of growth becomes way higher than the value of profitability. So it works in cycle. In current scenario, profitability is a little more sort of valuable compared to growth. In some other cases, this. But this is valid for cases where the business model is not flawed, right? That every new order you make money, but you are losing money because your investment in new sort of markets or customers or so on and so forth. So that is the sort of corollary.
The business model that you mentioned, let's say for Zomato as well, where they prioritize growth over, let's say, making profits, that seems to be like the general trend, no? I mean, at least most of the companies that at least I can think of, the emphasis is on growth rather than making profits. And I think that's what they also, prioritize as well. Is that fair or?
So that's what actually, if you ask me, that's what the startup is, right? If you're going at 10% per year or year, why would I buy you or something? Hindustan Liver, Unilever grows at 10-15% year on year. So startup in essence is growth, right? But it's not growth at all cost, right? So you have to see your business model is working, business model is solid, and then you obviously have to grow. Otherwise, you are dead, right? You are not a startup. So that is like a non-negotiable. You have to grow. And you have to keep on growing.
Is there a case you can think of where emphasis on growth was placed, but that did not give any returns to VCs, or the company went bankrupt, even though they achieved like a lot of scale and growth?
So I think there is one example in the which you keep on hearing in the news, right? One edtech company. So So I think the point of this is that there is not enough depth in the market, right? So you invest in things, you bring on board customers, which will never be future. So remember what I pointed out, you are in loss because you are investing in things which will pay off in future, right? But let's say you are acquiring some customers who are just using you just for the discount and they will never come back in a customer, they were never. So I think as a startup founder, you have to be very sure on what is the market depth in this any kind of country, right? You have good proxies for it. For example, if you are a tech company, you can see how much students are there, how much students are going to tuitions, how much tuition. You can't expect that if I spend lots of money, people will suddenly leave school, let's say, right, and just focus on edtech and companies, those kinds of things. So you'll have to analyze the depth of the market, and you should be saying that. Obviously, you have to push the foundation because as a leader, you have to do that, but don't go way beyond it, right? Don't spend on customers or don't spend on regions or activities which do not have a fixed payoff. It's easier said than done, right? It's a very hindsight thing. It's easy to say at this point of time, this guy did that wrong, that right. But as a founder, I think it's very difficult call. But I think when in the lower interest rate environment, which it was in 2021, right? There was a lot of growth on focus on growth, irrespective of unit economics, which is not a very good thing. I think you should focus on your unit economics, that every unit you are selling, at least you are making money, even if not at the company level. And the new investments you are doing will pay off in the future. It's a difficult thing to sort of gauge, but I think founders have to be honest about it, on how large is a particular market, how large this business can become.
Do you think it's difficult for Byju's to survive? Like from...
I won't be able to comment on that. So.
Going back on, so on the cycles, so when you mentioned how investors make, let's say, necessarily in multiple rounds, let's say A, B, C, seed round, people who invested in seed can cash out, let's say, in A or B or C. That cycle can go on forever, right? In the sense that there is no need that a company has to, per se, IPO for seeing returns or being liquid. That cycle can theoretically go forever, where new investors come in and maybe the old investors go out. Is that fair, or am I missing something here?
Sorry, just could you repeat? You are saying that when the new investors come in?
So generally, at least my thinking about this is a company might raise few rounds, and then there is this expectation that they will IPO in some time, or you know, in a few years they will IPO. But for private companies, in theory, I feel like when you mentioned, you know, seed investors, when new investors come in, let's say Series B, the seed investors can cash out and then get going. So that in theory can go on for, like, let's say ever, right? Because let's say new investors can always come in at an extended period of time, and a company can never have to go public if they keep finding private investors, right? Is that fair, or?
So in some cases that has happened. So for example, there are a few luxury brands in France which are not still public, right? Or in few cases, there are some US tech companies which are valued at more than $50 billion and still not gone public, right? So that is an option. But I think, see, what is the eventual goal your company of? You're starting a company, right? You want to become, leave it legacy of it. You think that should be profitable. People should be making money out of it. That can happen in two ways. Either retain it as a family business, right? So that's one way. Or second way, go public. I think the third way, we have not seen many companies which are owned by, not by a family and still private, right? There are private companies which are owned by families, run by generation of families. That works. Or the other way around, if you are run professionally, you go sort of public. I think there will be very few companies in the bucket which are neither of those. So this is sort of, and your point on when the new investor can come in, it can go on and on. It always doesn't happen, right? There might be some conflict where the new guy is coming in, say, I will give you the valuation, which is half the of the last round valuation. What you do as a founder, right? What you do as an early investor. So it's not that easy that every round you will find a new buyer. And the secondary exit, which I will mention, it's not given, right? It's an option which the founder may provide, or the new investor wants to acquire. But it never sort of, it's not for given, right? That's equity for you, right? It's a risk you are taking and the business you are underwriting.
So we have discussed financing methods. We looked at venture and debt as well. So assuming that once we have the money, let's say we raise a seed or series A or series B, and we have the money in the bank, how should we think about capital allocation? And also, like, I would assume that there is a difference between being a startup and allocating capital, and maybe let's say when you're a small public company and how you're allocating capital, and when you're a large company and how you allocate capital. So I think there are differences to it as well. At least intuitively, I feel that way. Could you speak to about like the skill of capital allocation? How important is it? What difference does it make? A lot of questions, but just if you can give us a sense of it.
Sure, I think this is a very, very sort of valid sort of questions. So I think what you're asking is, if I'm a CEO or a CFO, how do I sort of manage my capital, what I have raised, right? So I think, as a job of a CEO, CFO, I think there are two main motives of capital raising, right? One is that my team should not have a constraint of capital for normal functioning, let's say salaries are paid on time, vendors are paid on time, everything is going smooth. So that means when we discuss in VC question, runway, right? You have a certain runway that if the typical loss you are making today, you have enough money in the bank to last 18 months, 24 months, right? So that is one number one job. And that has to be taken care of, because you can't be doing different things and all if you don't have the money in the bank account. Second thing is, why you raise capital? You raise capital to make shareholder value, right? You want to make money for yourself, for your investors, for your employees, and in the vendor ecosystem. And all this you will be able to do if you're adding some value for your customers, for your vendors and everything, right? So the second goal of yours is, whatever you're doing with the money, you're creating shareholder value. But the shareholder value means is, in a very simplistic way, it will say that you are taking market share, or you are gaining market share, or you are making profits in a later stage of the company. And potentially the amount of capital which has gone in the company, let's say a company over a 5-year period has raised 100 crore rupees, right? Today, if someone wants to buy that company and buy all the shareholders in the company, including the founders, that exit should be more than 100 crore. That exit should be 200 crore, 250 crores, right? Because, or a 1,000 crore exit, because the investor made money, the founders made money, employees made money to ESOPs. And because someone is buying your company, that means you are doing something right. So either you are in a territory which no one was there, you have a huge market share, or you have strong network effects. Let's say take an example of WhatsApp, right? So take an example of WhatsApp. WhatsApp was acquired when there was no revenue, but it was acquired for a strategic sort of importance, and see today where WhatsApp is, right? So either you are that kind of business, or you are a very profitable business and there are metrics on how people value you and you get an exit. These are the two basic things on what you should sort of value over the sort of your, what is the two things which you keep in mind that you should always keep the light on: enough money in the bank, and whatever you are doing with the money in the interest that you're creating shareholder value, right? These are the two things which you should keep in mind. And then obviously I think it differs across sort of stage, right? If you're very seed stage, pre-series A company, you spend all your money on experimenting typically, right? So you don't have sort of anything else to do, because you don't want to turn profitable, but you have nothing to sell, right? So you tweak something, you say what will work, what will not work, and this is how you spend your seed, pre-series A, and maybe you start getting some feedback from the market. Customers are liking your product. People call it PMF, right? Product market fit. That there's a market for the product which you are selling. That's what happens at the seed. And so people should optimize, founders should optimize that all the money which I'm getting should be spent on that focus area that I was to. If I have a hypothesis that this thing is broken, this thing can be fixed this way, just try and figure out. If it doesn't work, just try something else, but don't try like 5-10 things, right? Because you'll not be able to focus area. Typically, the number of employees would be 10, 20, 30, how spread you can thin. So that is how you should use. When you go to a Series A or Series B stage, right, you know you have a understanding of your business model, your new market, and you. So this worked in, let's say, Bangalore. You want to check if it will work in Chennai, it will work in Delhi, it will work in Mumbai. So the Bangalore, you keep on focusing, improving on your unit economics, and Delhi, Chennai, you start doing again those experiments. If you're a SaaS company, let's say you took this 2 years to build your product, do a POC where people did not pay you, but let's say people pay you a very small amount, but it worked. And now you are in those ecosystem. And now Series A, B, you start selling, you starting recruiting. And so now you're spending money. You should be very prudent that I'm spending 1 rupee money, that how it will come back to me in some form or way, right? So some signs to the money I allocate. So it, this is known as a, if you see a typical P&L, so you have a sales, gross margin, contribution margin, EBITDA number, PBT number. There are various form or way, but you should be prudent of that. As you go at a later stage, Series C or D, again, you keep on focusing on growth, but you again refine your business model. So I think it goes on that way. And if you become a public company, then obviously you are inside of the public, you do quarterly calls, and you are guided somewhat by the markets and what you want to do. So that is sort of this business. So ultimately, what is objective? Objective is to become a public company, which is growing at a very high rate and throwing free cash flow, which is another better replacement for, let's say, profitability. Let's say free cash flow, it says. So you're growing at a very fast rate and you are free cash flow positive, right? If these two things are there, you are a best in the market, right? Think about Google, think about Microsoft. They are churning out money, free cash flow, and they're growing also. They're not distributing the cash flow to their own because, and again, this is a wishful thinking that I will have high free cash flow and high growth. Usually either one of these things happen, right? There are very few companies who can grow also and who throws off lots of cash also, right? Our IT companies, the TCS, Infosys, they generate a lot of free cash flow. People love them, right? But their growth rate is a little, let's say they'll grow at 15% year on year over a longer trajectory. They won't be growing at 50% year on year. The other cases like a Zomato or a Paytm, they will grow by 50-60% year on year. Touch wood, hopefully they'll grow. But they will not have any free cash flow till now. Unless they stop growing, they will not be able to give back the money. Or on the other case, you have a Google or a Microsoft who core businesses like a search or a YouTube, they're throwing off money, right? They're profitable, they're throwing off money. And then they are using this money internally to offer some other bets, which help them grow a lot. Let's say Google is become Bard, artificial intelligence, all sorts of things. So there you have likes of both sort of worlds in a very good proxy kind of way. But generally, companies at a life cycle point either focuses on free cash flows or on growth. And some people try to sort of balance it out.
In the sense that... my understanding of like why people invest in like venture as opposed to, let's say, public markets is because the returns are outsized, right? Is that fair, or am I missing something more fundamental?
No, expectation of return is outsized. The realization may or may not happen, but yeah, you are right. Over a longer term period, the idea should be that as all venture capital investors, we should be beating the public market fair and fair. Otherwise, there is no point. Why should it exist, right? It's not, as you mentioned, it's not a charity, right? People are investing because they expect a higher return. Yes.
On run rate. So you also kind of mentioned that, that startups, they will look at their financials and they'll see, you know, how much run rate do I have? Do I have 18 to 24 months per se? But so one thing I'm kind of confused about is I have seen some startups raise like to the tune of like, let's say $300 million, $400 million in a round. And I feel like, so is there an implicit agreement that, you know, they will deploy that capital as soon as possible and maybe, grow as fast as possible. And that's why they have that capital. Also, like what I'm trying to understand is, can they keep that capital for more than, let's say, more than 5 years, 6 years? Can they keep that? Can they raise like a large amount of capital and then just like sit on it for like 6-7 years? Is that possible? Or is there an expectation that they have to spend it immediately or maybe, you know, get growth per se?
Yeah, obviously that's the expectation. Otherwise, why is the company raising so much money, right? And typically these things happen a lot in the US. You will see there are certain R&D companies. There was this competitor of ChatGPT who raised certain $100 million in the first round. It said nothing on the ground, right? For engineers. So those kinds of deal happen a lot in the US as well. India, it's a little less, but yeah, sometimes it happens. Idea is simple, right? Why do you need that kind of money? You need that kind of money because you want to spend on R&D or something which is very unpredictable and which you will not be able to know in, let's say, $5-10 million, right? You will not be able to prove or disprove your theory. You need a lot more to prove or disprove your theory, and hence you need more money. That's beside the point. If the venture VC fund who wants to give you that kind of money, right? That's happened. But the expectation is right. And your point on if they can sit on the money, they cannot, because there are VC investors also on board, right? They are on the board sitting and discussing every quarter with the founder on what should be the trajectory of the company in terms of growth, margins, everything. Obviously, the founders are the one who guide the company and who run the company, but VCs also put in a word. And see, come to your initial point, right? Your point on private equity investors deserve a higher sort of higher returns than a public market. If you're not growing, where is that return going to be? So if you're not growing, probably you are investing in R&D or doing something very, very different, which does not exist in the world. But if it is more of a commerce business, you want to sell something, then I think people, that money is for to grow. And maybe you want to experiment with some money on some adjacent markets. So some money could be for that.
A small digression. So we discussed WhatsApp earlier. What do you think is like the best acquisition, according to you, that was ever made?
That's a very difficult question, but I think Google has demonstrated. I think YouTube was a very good acquisition, and they acquired it when it was sort of nothing. I think it was 2005 or 6, and Google was pretty young itself then, right? That was there, but I think I will rate that and the Facebook acquisition of WhatsApp at $19 billion without a cent of revenue, right? I think in this way, I think Mark Zuckerberg is one of the best sort of, if you can put it, a capital allocator or a thinker, right? He's a very, very good guy. He's Facebook is dying, so he has WhatsApp. WhatsApp would be profit cutter. He has Instagram and whatnot, right? So I think he's one of the good sort of excellent kind of CEO and some of the acquisitions which have worked, right?
I was actually going to ask you, after the acquisition, who do you think is the best capital allocator according to you? Would you still answer Mark Zuckerberg or?
So see, capital allocation also works in two ways. There's a organic and inorganic, right? What we discussed was inorganic. Inorganic is meaning you acquire a company from outside, not in you, right? You have the money, you have $100 million or you have $1 billion, you use $100 million to acquire another company because you think it will take a lot more time and effort to build something like that, right? Or the network effects will not come that soon, and it's very difficult to get a network effect because the earlier guy has already gotten it. And then there is organic opportunities, right? So organic opportunities could be that you are operating, let's say, in a healthcare space, you are doing diagnostics or something, right? And you think that hospitals is a nice thing, right? But you don't want to acquire hospital, but you think that my ethos will not work, my culture will not work, I want to make it from scratch, then you make it from scratch. But I think, see, most M&A on the inorganic side do not work, right? It's a very studied a lot that M&A people do it for boosting, CEOs do it for boosting their own value in terms of salaries or increasing the size of the company and all those.
I'm really sorry. So I just want to push back on this because when you mentioned this, the company that came to my mind was Disney. And I feel like Disney has done some insane is a strong word, but many acquisitions over the years. And I feel like they have, I mean, at least that's the, but to be fair, that's the only company that I can think of. Is that like an outlier example, or do you not agree with my thesis that it's done well because of the acquisition? Because I think they acquired Marvel, Pixar, Lucasfilms, or I think 21st Century Fox as well. Any thoughts on that?
So I think, see, again, I'm not aware of Disney's, how does acquisition pan out for Disney. Sometimes what happens now, you remember the brand name and you think that, wow, they have done some research. But see, it's also the amount they would have paid to those guys, right? So see, in the finance world, nothing is out of bound. I can invest in anything as long as the price is good. Obviously not anything, but let's say the top 60-70% companies I can buy if the price is good, right? And sometimes we see that paying a huge price for something does not pay well, even if the company is good. Microsoft gave zero return between 2000 and 2016 for 16 years on the stock market side, right? Even when the company was growing, because someone who would have bought Microsoft in 2000 would have paid an insane amount of multiple or a valuation multiple, right? So it always come down to the price you pay and the value you get. So in that sense, most does not work. I think Disney might have done it well. I think Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway is a Hathaway is a good example. They have the masters of it. They have built an entire business on inorganic also, but on the inorganic sort of growth. So they are the masters and the most successful people on it. On the tech side, I would put probably Mike Zuckerberg. In terms of the insane one, the smaller ones, obviously, Adobe does a lot of it, Accenture does a lot of it. But I think the kind of bet Zuckerberg has taken and has panned out, it's very well. But on the other side, if you see, Zuckerberg spent a lot on Metaverse, right? That did not give any sort of return in the sense that it did not took off as well. So that was, you can say on the hindsight.
But don't you think that's a bit too early in the sense like, it's only been 3 years.
Yeah, it's 2-3 years, but he has spent like, I don't know, about $20 billion or something like that. It's a very huge money which he has spent. So again, my point is that in hindsight, we could say it's right or wrong, or maybe we do not know it yet. But what I'm saying is it's difficult to do the acquisitions and doing organic growth and all. So people should keep wary of it. It might fail, it might succeed, but take learnings from why it failed and why it succeeded. And for that, for Metaverse, I don't know, maybe it works in the future. But again, this year, Facebook is spending a lot less on Metaverse, significantly less what it spent the last 2 years, because the market was hampering the share a lot, right? It was, share was going down a lot. And since he has said that this is a year of efficiency and he has cut down the investment in Metaverse, share price is 3x up in just 7-8 months. So you hear the market also sometimes in the what is the market wants and how is the cost of capital.
Any comments on the Microsoft acquisitions as well? I think Microsoft also ends up doing a lot of acquisitions. I think they acquired LinkedIn. Activision also, I think they acquired. GitHub, I think they acquired. At least those are the few acquisitions. Any comments on that? Or
yeah, so to come point now, I will link 2 points here. So remember I told you growth and free cash flows. So Microsoft has a lot of free cash flow between 2016. But what they did not have where
at this point, can you just maybe just define by free
profits.
Cash flow?
Okay. Just take up profits for us. They have a lot of profits, but what do they do with the profit? Right? Market also expects them to grow, but there was no where they could grow. This is till 2015-16. After Nadella came in, right? He, if you think about it, he sort of redid all the whole strategy, right? The Windows got to be online, so it was not like 8, 9, 10, now it's a perpetual Windows, which are on the licensing basis. Microsoft Office went from a, you don't have to buy everything, it went on a subscription basis, right? They bought LinkedIn, they bought GitHub and other things. So now, market likes a lot. If you see in the 2017 or so, 23, I don't know how much, but Microsoft stock has given insane returns. And the idea is their main business keep on giving that cash or the profit. And they keep on doing this good acquisition, which are working. So LinkedIn is working. GitHub is also a very, very good sort of investment. And obviously Activision, when it gets a regulatory approval, that would also be a good sort of acquisition for them. So Microsoft is a good example of turnaround on how the new CEO came and he did all the sort of the right things.
The stock is up 650% from the time Nadella has joined. Yeah.
See, that's what I'm saying, right? So I think the strategy, what they pivoted and the cash flows, the profits they were getting, they invested in sort of right kind of assets which they acquired.
I want to close the loop on acquisition, but before that, I want to ask you, I think one company that does not do, at least to my knowledge, does not do a lot of acquisition is Apple, if I'm not wrong. Either they do a lot of acquisition, but they are not public about it. Any thoughts on that or?
No idea. I don't know. I have not. Do not have. I think maybe it's in the ethos because they have done some acquisitions, if you find online. But yeah, you are right. These are very small acquisitions for, let's say, a design aspect or buying an IP or buying a patent, those kinds of things. They never acquire, let's say, someone is making an iPad equivalent and they acquire it and launch under their name because their DNA is very different. I think they work on that products and all. So I don't have any insight, but probably that could be the reason.
When it comes to capital allocation, does the buck stop? Like, does the core skill have to be with the CFO or the CEO, or like who has to develop that skill, do you think?
I think, till Series A or B, this is needed a little less, right? Because frankly, you are just trying to figure out how to grow and how to make money. But from a Series C, if you typically from Series C onwards, founders get a CFO on board. And now on the corporate governance point of view, there is a huge push that there should be outsider CFO, not linked to a founder, or one of the founders should not be a CFO. That is for a corporate governance point of view. And one thing is obviously on this part as well, which is the skill set which is there. So I think CFO has to think it a lot more strategically and more tactically as well. And founders should also know about it. So I think the bucks obviously buck every time stops at a founder or so, but many responsibilities CFOs take care of it after a certain point of time. And this happens a lot more in certain type of businesses. Let's say I was explaining a lending business, a B2B commerce business, when there are a lot more transactions, right? There the role is even more prominent. If it's a, let's say if it's a company where it's more tech and less transaction, so there, this can be slightly less important.
As an investor, I think now I'm blurring the lines between, I'm not very clear in terms of like early stage startups or let's say public, like how do we know what is a company's capital allocation strategy? Like if it's a public company, do I just look at their acquisitions or what do I see in their filings that will give me the sense of what their strategy is? Is there a specific section? Yeah, like how should we think about that?
See, I think there is no one, it's a little complicated and it's little not a nuances to it. See, it's very, one way is very simple. I do not care if you do a capital allocation right or wrong. As an investor, as a stock market investor, if I made my money on your company or not, right? Let's say you think that I do all the checklist and everything is fine, but why the stock market is, let's say the share is going down for consecutively for the last 5 years, right? Then there is something wrong if this. So I think the way to check is obviously the prima facie is how's the stock performing, stocks and dividends, how are those? So total return, how much the return I am getting from my investor, and that is a very good precursor. If you see the kind of companies which have sort of grown big, the Reliance of the world, the IT companies, the FMCG, the consumer companies in India, they have generated a lot of shareholder value. HDFC Bank, right? It listed at 10,000 rupees. I think if you adjust for all the splits, bonus and all those things, I think it would probably be, I don't know, if more than maybe 1,000x kind of return from that kind of number, at least. So I think that is a one sort of, one thing if you want to check, that is there. But if you want to go into a specifics, and if you are a CFO or a finance guy, or you want to go into specific, so check the financial statements, how is the leverage in the company. Debt leverage is basically the debt by equity ratio. How much is debt? How much is equity? What is the ROE of the business? The return on equity, return on capital employed, return on invested capital. Then what do they do when they get these all the profits every year? Do they distribute it to the shareholders via dividend? Or they are investing all the money in the new sort of growth trajectory? Are they not wasting money, right? Sometimes we have seen some activism where activist investors are there, some of the activists. They are said that return the money to me because the way you are investing money is not a sort of the right way, right? Sometimes that also friction does not happen, but it's a little less, but sometimes it happens. And then where is the focus? Are they focused on a certain sort of segment? Are they diversifying? Is the diversification good for the business or not? So these are the few tactical things you can check. But I think buck stops at how is your share performance compared to the sort of the stock market index value and compared to your peers as well, right? If a sector is not doing good, then it's okay, right? If you're also not doing for a short period of time.
So this is also one digression which I want to make, in the sense that so I have heard that Apple has over, like, I don't know, 200 billion in cash available to them. I think they just have it lying around. I mean, I don't know if they get...
They distribute. So Apple is very similar to in the cash flow terms in terms of our IT companies, Infosys, TCS. I'm not saying the business model is same. I'm not saying the return on equity is same, but I'm saying how they use money is pretty similar. So TCS, Infosys also generate a lot of cash. If you check their balance sheet, they will have a couple of billion dollars available. So, and given their business model does not need more capital, right? If you are Infosys or TCS, you want to grow by 20%, you do not need more capital, right? You want to hire some new folks, that's all it, right? You do not need more money. So what they do is they share it back with the investors in two forms. One is dividend, one is buyback. Dividend, I don't know if you know, it's very simple. You own one share, they will declare a 5 rupee dividend per share. Every shareholder will get 5 rupee. So they do it every 6 months, every year. Some companies do every quarter as well, right? That's one way. Second way is they do buyback of shares. What does buyback mean here? Let's say there are 100 shares which are outstanding in the company. And company says, I have enough cash. I have distributed dividend as well. Now I have still some cash remaining with me. I'll do a buyback. So how buyback benefits is, let's say the share market price is TCS would be whatever, let's say 2800, 3000 rupees, let's say. They will buy back the share at 3500 rupees. So they say that whoever wants to sell the share to me, not to a stock market, you can sell at 3000. But I will buy back 2% of the share which are outstanding at 3500 rupees. So the guy who is selling, he benefits, right? Instead of 3000, he is getting 3500 at that point of time. And the guy who, and the shareholders who did not sell the shares, they also benefit, because next year, just think it from a perspective of dividends. Now you have, the dividend can be distributed in 98 shares instead of 100 shares. So each of the remaining guy will get more dividend next year, right? Assuming the total amount of absolute dividend is same. Say Apple does the same thing. They do buybacks. I don't know if they do dividends, but they definitely do buybacks. They do a lot of buybacks, in fact. I think the kind of buybacks they do, they have reduced their number of shares by 1/3 in the last 6-7 years. So that is also a good shareholder value, because even if you are not growing, let's say you're 7 years, you'll not have grown. But per share wise, because the shares have gone by 33%, per share value has increased by 1/33, which is more than, say, 40% or so. Got it? So this is two ways how people give back the cap, the companies give back the cash.
But even after doing your dividends and share buybacks, I think they still have a lot of money left with them. So there, I'm guessing that they don't have, they're not very clear about the investment strategy. So they're just holding it. Is that fair, or am I missing something?
So you're right. So that's known as controlling your, or keeping your balance sheet strong, right? See, tomorrow, you never know what kind of things happen, right? Let's say there's a tax claim of $20 billion it comes. You do not want to be in a scenario where, as a company, you have money for your regular operation, but something one-off happens, right? You get a claim from a US government, did not pay $20 billion of taxes. Or on the other way around, on a good part, let's say some company is there in the market which wants to be acquired and you like it. So it's not like you keep, let's say it's with you as well, right? You have a rainy day fund, right? Think of it as a rainy day fund, right? Your job goes for 6 months. What do you do? How do you manage your cash flow for that? So this is primarily, and I think many companies, it's a prudent practice. You should keep money for your rainy day fund. It could be for some acquisition you want to do, or some extraordinary thing like a COVID happens and your profits go down from plus 50 to minus 50 and all those things. So this is for mainly for rainy fund. But that being said, it's very prudent. You should not be keeping excesses, right? It's like, you are keeping so much cash that you can pay dividend for 50 years, right? That is insane. Better return the money to the shareholders via buyback or a dividend.
In the first half of our conversation, I think a term that came up multiple times, but I did not really understand completely, which is fine, because a lot of things I won't understand as well, is cost of capital. You explained this before, so maybe... it's up to you if you want to touch upon that again. But also, like, how does it relate to, like, one is executives making decision about their capital allocation strategies, and like, why is it important? Because I think cost of capital is a term that I don't think appears a lot in, like, mainstream journals. Like, if you read I think The Economist or Financial Times or whatever, cost of capital you will not get to hear a lot, I feel. So why is it, can you motivate, like, why is it important, and, like, how does it matter per se?
So I'll come to how is it used first, right? So if you see any company valuation, there is a method known as discounted cash flow. Basically what it says is, at the end of each year or the end of each quarter, how much the company makes the money or needs the money. So in the first 5-6 years of your journey, this number will be the free cash flow, which I was referring to. It's a sort of a, for lack of a better word, it's profits adjusted for some other things. So basically at the end, if I was a company, if today I want to pull it money, every quarter, how much money I will be needed or I would be putting in the company. So for the first 5-6 years, this will be negative. Basically company needs the money. And then later on, let's say from 7th year to 8th year, company is throwing out cash, right? Throwing out the profits or cash. So how do I value a company today sitting here? So the math says is you discount the future cash flows by the cost of capital. Meaning, what does it mean is I do, let's say year two, may the number is minus 100. So it would be minus 100 divided by 1 plus cost of capital by 2. So basically, I'm taking the today value of the cash flow, which was in year 3, year 4, year 5, and I'm adding all it, right? So if you'll see, the cash flows in my hand, right, as a company hand, but it is divided by a number which is 1 plus cost of capital. So higher the cost of capital, lower is your company's valuation, right? Typically, if you are making the same revenue and same profit and same everything, right? If the two companies, everything is the same, the company with the lower cost of capital will be the more beneficial sort of, or more sort of valuable company. So that's why it is important. And now why we divide by that kind of number is, basically we divide it by that kind of number is because if you want to take money in the company, this is the average return the investor will expect, either as a equity or a debt or a blend of equity. Generally, it's a blend of equity and debt, right? So that is there. So it becomes very important because think about it. If you are investing in a business, or as I am a CEO, I'm thinking a new project came in, let's say a factory which I want to open up, and this will give me certain profits, certain revenue, certain costs, certain profits. And I will take sort of, I will do the DCF calculation, discounted cash flow methodology. And my IRR, which I'm getting out of this cash flows, it's lower than my cost of capital. Then there's no point of doing the business, right? You are taking some money and at, let's say, 15% blended, and you are generating 12%. You're in the wrong business. You should not be doing that. Either do a project which gives you a higher IRR than your cost of capital, or reduce your cost of capital by some way. But that being said, cost of capital cannot be also be reduced a lot, right? It's dependent on some external factors. How much do you take debt you take, but what is the cost of sort of, which I was saying, right? The US G-Sec rate, or in the India G-Sec rate, government bond rate, right? If that has increased, so this 15%, what I was saying, the expectation the equity guy has, that is a equity cost of capital. That cost of capital for a public company would be, let's say, 10%. So the blended would be somewhere between 12-13%, right? So every project has to give you that 12-14% at least return to just to break even, maybe 20%, so you generate sort of profit for the company. So that's how, sort of from a corporate finance perspective, how we think about, you take a new project, your IRR should be better than the cost of capital of your firm.
But in that sense, like, the stage at which a company is in should not really matter, right? I mean, even if you're an early stage or growth stage or a public or you're like a big tech per se or a big corporation, your math will still be the same. Is that fair? Or
math will be the same, but the numbers will be unpredictable. So if you are a very early stage Series A company, you cannot project a 7-year cash flow, 6-year cash flow. It's like, see, I can prove anything, right? I can prove my investment is giving me 50% also and 10% also. So there is less need to do that because, frankly, it's on everything on Excel. Versus if you are a cement manufacturer, right? You have been in the business for 30 years, you're putting up a new cement plant. We're very sure of generally how does the prices change? What is the volume? How does it take? It's very predictable. So generally this is done at a later stage, more in public companies than in startups, because startups, you cannot do this, frankly.
I'm not able to probe this subject very well. So is there anything else that you want to touch on cost of capital per se?
Nothing much. I think broadly this is it. Yeah. I think the way on the corporate finance perspective, how do companies evaluate is the IRR this project generates. So typically it goes like this, right? If you, it was taught in our MBA classes, you have a machine which is running. It is producing 6, let's say, mobile phones every day. and it's going on, you are making certain profits and all. There is a new machine which came in, which is worth 1 crore rupees. It will produce 12 mobiles a day. But the point is, if you want to get that machine, you have to throw out the existing machine. Would you buy that new machine or would you not buy that new machine? So what you have to do is, you are putting in 1 crore capital, but you are getting that additional 6 mobile phones, and you will be able to produce that for, let's say, next 10 years. So that's the cash flow which this new machine generates is able to compensate for the 1 crore you are putting in, and the 10-year life of the existing machine was still left. So the delta you are making is 6, 12 minus 6, not 6, right? So these are the kind of things. So should you buy the machine or not? So that was the kind of questions which are typical, let's say, old school business, which is people are running, they will keep on evaluating. People do it in their hand, because generally machines sort of, let's say, they get a new machine in 3 years or some years. But if it's a longer project, it's more institutionalized, you do these kinds of calculations. Should you buy the machine? Should you not buy the machine? The point can be, how are you buying that machine? How are you funding that 1 crore? If it's a bank giving you a loan, are you taking money from the banks or from the company? Does company have sort of benchmarks on, we will not take a project which is less than this IRR? So generally, some companies on the listed side have some sort of benchmarks that we will not do a project which gives a certain IRR. Now I will put you another question on this machine, right? There is another machine apart from this second one. There's a third machine which can do 24 mobile phones a day, right? But the catch here is, that machine will work only for 5 years, not for 10 years, right? So should you buy it and not? And what will you do after 5 years? So the optionality there is, maybe after 5 years, there is an even cheaper version of the machine, because there is more sort of progress happening, right? So what do you put? If you compare this 10-year cash flow versus 5-year cash flow, should you use IRR as a good method, or there is a thing called net present value? Is that a net? So there is a very caveat, and people justify it both ways also. But it's very interesting. So see, if you are a large company, you are making these kinds of decisions, you do this kind of calculation. I have worked in a real estate side also, commercial real estate. So there it's very prominent, right? Because that's, everything is driven on cash flows. So it comes from there. From startup side, it's a little less useful, because once you become big, then you can do these kinds of calculation.
So the final phase I have for today is, wanted to touch a little bit upon maybe slight differences between private equity versus venture capital. But wanted to ask you as well, is there anything else you want to touch on before we maybe move on to private equity, which we haven't done?
Sure. I think one thing I wanted to discuss is on biases. I think that is very important. And maybe I can give like 2-3 minutes on that. So, and then we can finish it by private equity venture. So see, biases are very, very sort of important, right? The way I was explaining you this 5-year, 10-year, right? In mathematics and in those cash flows, I can prove by the 5-year one, 10-year one, both. You ask me to prove that, I can prove that. You ask me to prove that 10-year is beneficial, I can prove that also. So I think biases have to be kept in mind, and this happens on the private side as well, public side as well, right? So for example, there are a couple of biases, which is, the first one is very, very important, is optimism bias. So when you do this discounted cash flow method...
So just to interrupt, so in a sense, just to backtrack, when you're talking about biases, you're talking about like when you're investing or when we are allocating capital, is that fair or?
Okay. So I am talking more from a CAO or CFO perspective. So if you are someone on the board, right, or even if you're a stock market investor, when you're evaluating a company, and this is especially true if you can influence the decision making as well, then it helps. And the idea is, if someone is influencing you, you should know, right? People do not know if someone is influencing them, right? So you should be keeping in mind when you're meeting with a founder and saying that, you should have something in mind that you will know, right? Some people you mean, yeah, this guy is very, very optimistic. He always says this, but he's never able to deliver on, let's say, even half of this. Or the other way around, you're saying that this guy, I believe whatever he says, he delivers that, and he's never over promises, right? And there are other biases as well. So those things I wanted to sort of discuss. And this is very important in a financial point of view, because there is no numbers on it, right? But it's very important, because if you judge something is on the Excel sheet, but how reliable that is, you should know. So a couple of biases which I wanted to discuss. First one is the optimism bias, which is very true. And as a bias also, I think if you are a founder, you have to be optimistic. But if you are a sort of an investor or someone else who's working, you should know how much optimism is correct, right? And optimism bias, I will say how it will work about it, right? Let's say you are doing a DCF and something is not working, unit economics is not working. Someone can justify by saying that a new customer will be us for 4 years, not 3 years, right? And the calculations change, right? Now you can say that, no, we have seen in the last 3 years data, typical customer stays with us for 3 years. How come it will be 4 years? No, I believe that this can happen and all those things, right? So there are certain things which the optimism is one of the things. It's good to have. But if someone is giving a vague estimate, someone is having a very broad sort of sense that, you know, the market is very large enough, or market will double in 5 years on a certain set, which has not doubled in the last 5 years. So those kinds of things we should keep in mind, right? That if someone is saying that the optimism is backed by numbers up to a certain extent. Then there is one more thing, which there's an expert bias, which is very well known one. That happens is that you always say that I get this report from someone. This guy is saying that this will happen, and he's an expert. It could be someone, could be a known person in the industry, some a consultant or someone else.
Generally, people say, like, you know, a psychologist from Harvard or, you know, the Stanford. Name dropping.
I'll come to that's another one. But this is not just name dropping, but you're saying because that expert is saying. But you, if you do some research and all, you will find out. And this is very true in economics, right? When people predict the GDP growth. If the students were asked to pick about what will be the growth rate or the GDP growth rate for the next two quarters, you were given two options to choose. Either you could choose any one expert and whatever prediction he had given, you take that prediction. Or the other option was given, you had given the list of 20 experts, you average it out, you take an average of it. What do you choose? So 20% people chose the expert, 80% chose the average, and they were correct, right? When the actual GDP reading came, it was more close to what was the average estimate than what the expert was sort of claiming. And this happens repeatedly in every industry, right? But that being said, it should not be the case that every time you take a consensus opinion, because sometimes not everyone will agree to everything. But if you are doing, and this is for a more of a mature company, if you are basing your analysis on some expert, it's better to get other opinions. It's better to get vetted, because experts might be wrong, and you should not be just putting in that expert says there will be 1 billion electric vehicles on the road by 2030. You should believe it. You should get opinions from 3-4 more folks and use your own brain to sort of and do those sort of cash flows. Then the next is one, I don't know if you know, is a principal agent problem. So principal agent problem is a very typical bias. Principal agent problem says that there is a principal, there is an agent. Principal is generally the owner. Agent is someone who's working for the owner. So if it's in the startup case, principal and agent both are the same. Founder is the owner and founder is the CEO. In public companies, let's say in Reliance, it's pretty same, right? Ambani family owns 50% and they are also the CEO. In ITC, it's the other way around, right? There is no family which owns it. The shareholding is diverse and the management controls it. So what's the principal agent problem says is the owner and the operator, they have different incentives. Agent will work on things which he thinks will advance his thing. Your point on M&A, we have seen places where there is a management control or there is not a founder family or a large private equity VC investor. Those kind of companies go for a higher M&As. Why? Because the CEO can say, I manage 2,000 people instead of 1,000 people. I get a higher salary, right? Because the top line is higher, the revenue is higher. While it might not be result in a better shareholder value, which is a principle, the shareholder value, because you acquired a company for a very fair price, it might not grow at a very fast pace or something. It will have to be seen in a specific context, but more likely than not, this problem occurs. The principal and the agent do not agree on the same thing. So whenever these kinds of cases are there, you'll have to have some incentive. So the agent is also aligned in, but the principal is also aligned. So give him. So that's why you see, right? Tim Cook gets ESOPs. Why he doesn't get all the salary? Why he does get ESOPs? Because that's to put him the the ESOP cost or the principal thinking hat on his hat, that if you will grow, you will get 1 rupee as salary, you will get 10 rupees as ESOP, right? You are more of a principal for us than as the agent.
So you aligning the incentives.
Aligning the incentives for the principal and the agent. Then I think couple of just 2-3 more, and we'll sort of wrap this section up. So one is anchoring bias. This happens a lot. Anchoring bias says that, let's say I come to you, I say that this new phone is coming. Will you buy it for 40,000? It's a very great phone. Amazing. You're saying no, 40,000 is more costly. And I do this research. People say it's more costly, but then I came up with not 40,000. It's a 32,000 cost. It buys it. Versus if I had gone with you, will you buy a 32,000 phone? You're saying no, I get the same features in a 25K phone. So because the anchor to your mind was 40,000, you think this is cheaper, and many people use it, right? And consumer companies use it a lot in the marketing sense. So to anchor to you a certain extent and then say that it's cheaper or it's costlier, right? People use it, let's say, in Starbucks coffee, small, medium, large. The difference between medium and large is not much, but you think that medium is for what, 400, 450 for large. You don't say that 400 for a coffee is too much, because you already have a set anchor in mind, the medium is worth 400 rupees. So people use it a lot. And marketing is mostly all about it. Sales people do it. Then the next one, which is very important, is recency bias. I am biased by the things which happened with me recently. And case in point is the valuations. You know, the valuations have corrected in the market ecosystem, right? People are saying that no, last 1.5 years back, I raised at 20x of revenue multiple. Today you are giving me 10x revenue multiple. My valuation is still the same. But it's a recency bias. You go 7 or 8 years down the line, the multiples were very similar to, let's say, which is it's today, right? To 2021 probably was the aberration, not the norm, right? So recency bias is there, that it happens in appraisals, right? Whatever you do in Jan-Feb, March is on the top of the mind. Promote people forget what you do in April, May, June. So recency bias is very important. You have to be very sure, you note down things otherwise, and you do not base everything on a few recent things which has happened. And you should judge everything by the absolute way, where it is current to the compared to the other things which are happening today. So this is on one. And the last one, which you were also mentioning, is the social proof. The social proof, the scarcity, FOMO. If he's investing in, you are doing a podcast, why shouldn't I do it? If he's investing in an EV company, why shouldn't I? I think there might be very different rationale to why you are doing it, why I should do it. So you should not do something, and this happens in investment world as well. If someone, you see the AI investments, right? I think 70% or 80% of the investments in the last quarter or so in US happened in the AI startups. So that being said, I'm not saying that AI is nothing. I think I'm very, very bullish about AI. But sometimes some part of it is driven by FOMO also, that I miss out, everyone else is doing. If I talk to someone, I haven't invested in an AI company, what will I say, right? So those kinds of companies should also happen. So as an investor, you should have very, very strong internal validation, not external validation. If other people are doing it, more likely than not, there is something to do about it. But don't do it when other people are doing it. Get convinced that this is good, and then you obviously take your bet. So this is, I think, my sort of sense. And obviously, you should be safe from these biases by using a checklist or doing things. And you know that these things can happen. So this is you should be aware of it and then try to avoid it as far as possible.
I think these biases, not only in investing, but I think even in daily life, I think they're very helpful if you understand them.
Yes.
Right? Like, yes. I'm thinking of let's say, nowadays it may not be very useful because of Uber and Ola, but even auto drivers, like if you're taking an auto or if you're taking a cab, anchoring, like one of the biases you mentioned, if they start quoting, let's say 300 rupees, and then they bring it down to 250, 200, you think they've bought it down to 100, you've gotten like a 100 rupee better offer. But that 200 is also a huge amount, so you don't think about it, and then you pay. And even you mentioned the Starbucks example, but also I can think of, like, let's say popcorn example in movie screens, theater, where, you know, I think the medium and large is priced so close by that you just go for the larger one. So even like daily consumer decisions also, I think this helps a lot.
So this is known as the decoy effect in the example we took for the coffee or the popcorn. Decoy. The medium one is essentially a decoy, right? No one wants you to buy it. Either you buy a smaller one, maybe if you just want to have a necessity of popcorn, or you buy a larger one because medium and large is not much different. So it's a decoy effect, which Apple also uses it, if you know, in their ranges. The medium one is generally very close to the highest price one because you will buy the highest one and not the middle one, basically.
So I think like the idea of biases was mostly popularized by Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yes.
But one thing I found fascinating in that book was at the end of the book, he writes, so I want to connect this to one of the things that you said, you know, one of the things, a way we can maybe overcome is maybe by using checklists or some other mechanisms. But at the end of the book, I think he also mentioned, you know, he's been studying about it his, you know, a large portion of his adult life. But even today, he, you know, he
happens,
still...
Yeah.
To these biases, and sometimes I think, you know, is it even worth you know, spending time trying to overcome when it is so difficult? And it's so, sometimes it's just it happens in a split second, right? I think, you know, how you mentioned that thinking two, or thinking one system and thinking two system, where the decision is already made and you're just like you're just slave to that opinion. So how are you thinking about that?
So you are right. I think we can't preach it in our daily life. It's very difficult. And you are right in the thinking first, thinking one system, right? It comes very intuitively to us. We do it. But I think as an investor, we have to be very wary of it because we are guardian of other people's money, right? So we are sure that we are not biased, right? So whenever we take, and I personally do it on our professional life, or the personal life also, whenever taking a big decision, I try to be aware of it if I am not being swayed away by any of these biases, right? So I think in the large decision which you make in life, you should definitely take care of it. And as an investor, every decision is a large decision from the investment side, right? Because you are investing a significant amount of money. That's why investment funds have checklists. And we do have checklists and everything. So we, at least on the base figure, we are covered that we are not swayed away by anything. And we like the company, we like the founder, we invest in it. But there is, when we see the underlying numbers and all, it's not there on checklist. So those kinds of things, sort of, to avoid those kinds of things, I think these are necessary. So maybe in the larger scheme of things, you should use that. In the smaller things of things, I think it's okay if someone is manipulating us or doing anchoring thing. That's fine. It's always, we can buy that large popcorn, so fine.
So maybe moving away from like practical stuff to like some philosophy, in the sense, I feel like... I think to avoid or to even think about these things, I think some amount of self-realization also is important, right? Or like the ability to introspect about your own decisions. Like I'm thinking about like FOMO is one, or like when you mentioned this, the last component where social proof, I think it's very, you need to have some amount of like personal identity, or, you know, some amount of introspection where you know why you want something. Like if you're only wanting stuff because your neighbor bought those Nike shoes and now today you also want some Reebok or Adidas shoes, then it becomes, then there is some disconnect. But if so I think that amount of like self-realization also is very important, I think. No,
yes, and people are actually, if you think about it, it's very difficult to do. I think it's easier to follow the trend. If everyone is buying an iPhone or everyone is doing that, you do that. It takes a lot of self-realization, and you should read about these stuffs as well. Half of the people don't know about it. So I've read this Thinking Fast and Slow. Some of the biases were covered in our CFA sort of curriculum. There's an entire sort of chapter on that, these kinds of 2025 biases which are there, right? So those kinds of things are there. I think if you keep on reading, you will sort of into it. And some people sort of realize it over their lifetime, right? Once they've seen sort of how their decisions pan out, people do it. But yeah, it's difficult to do, but you should have a self-realization. And typically, I'm also saying this, but if I think about it in the last week or so where I've used it, it was nowhere, right? I use it more for professional life, personal life. I think it sometimes goes to the back of our mind. So sometimes when you actively search for it, it's like motivation, right? You should obviously become aware of it, and then you can maybe use it in your sort of life.
I also feel like this is why I think courage to act also is like very important, in the sense, like going back to like social proof, like when you're trying something new, you don't want to be like, part of you is like embarrassed to admit it to other people that, you know, you're doing something which nobody else is doing. Let's say you're in an MBA class and like most of the class is doing consultancy, but you're doing some like a very very unique thing in agriculture, it'll be slightly weird to like admit to your peers and take that route. So I think courage also in that sense is like a prerequisite to do or try new things and face people as well. Yeah,
sure. And I'll give you an example of this on the VC investment side. So all the outside returns which have come in the VC world, right, have been in companies where the VCs were sort of little contrarian, but right. So you are investing in something which no one else wants to invest in. If everyone wants to invest in something, the price of that round will go on, right? You will get, let's check. So then the founder will also have to choose, right? And even if you're right, you will get, let's say, a 20x return, not a 100x return. Versus if no one is investing, you are choosing to invest, then you can price it the way you want. Obviously, the founder will agree and what is a realistic valuation. But and if you are right, you get that outsized return. So you get an outsized return when you are contrarian, but right. Being contrarian, doing the opposite thing and being wrong, you are at the worst quarter, sir.
Yeah, and that balance is very difficult to like anybody can be contrarian, but I think that contrarian and right is the most important. Yeah.
I think the idea should be you take enough contrarian bets and even sort of some conventional bet as well. You take some contrarian bets such that if those work, that returns your entire fund or that takes care of everything. But you do have to take your bet. Your point on courage, if you know it's a contrarian bet, if you're not taking it, right? And I'm saying from a VC fund perspective, right? If you are doing seed investing, you are investing in companies which you always understand. You're not doing any investment which you don't understand. I think you will not be able to return your fund, right? You'll have to take some bets on the seed stage, which you think would have outsized return. You don't understand how, but you like the founder, you like the market, you think there is something there. You should take those bets. And then we will see if it relies on.